Okay.
And Alvedo went down there very often.
Yeah.
So we were not involved in those negotiations
okay.
directly at all. We were not sitting at the table with anybody.
Okay.
You know, we had a very intimate relationship with the administration of President Cristiani, obviously.
Okay.
This does not mean, and this is an important point, that President Cristiani always did everything we wanted, by any means.
Yeah.
But we basically were supportive of his position in the negotiations.
Okay.
And my job was to keep in close touch with, at least I made it my job, to keep in close touch with Alvaro de Soto.
Okay.
Make sure he understood where we stood on all these issues.
Okay.
And from time to time, Bernie Aronson, who was really the key figure in the administration on all this, was Assistant Secretary of State for American Affairs at the time, would come up to New York and meet with Alvaro de Soto, with Merrick Goulding,
okay.
Iqbal Risa, and the other players, UN players, in this whole process. Sometimes the discussion could get heated and strong, if not actually acrimonious, because there was a feeling on the part of Bernie and to Romero and others in Washington that De Soto and the UN team, but particularly Alvedo, were leaning too much toward the FMLN positions.
Okay, yeah.
So my job and my sidekick, Joe Manso, whom is another guy who would be fun to talk to, but his memory, since he's younger than I am, his memory's probably better. We met with Alvedo de Soto, on a weekly, sometimes several times a weekly basis to talk about this stuff.
Okay.
Make sure that we were getting back to Bernie our best analysis of where Alvedo thought he was going and his analysis of the situation, as well as our making our points to Alvedo to make sure he didn't misunderstand where the U.S. was.
Okay, yeah.
And he, of course, understood that we were a crucial player in the negotiations, even if we weren't at the table.
Yeah.
So we had lengthy and very interesting discussions, and a review of the record of those conversations, I think, would be revealing.
There are notes of those conversations?
Well, they're probably all still classified in the State Department somewhere. Yeah, sure. Every time Joe Manso and I met with Alvedo, we did a comprehensive telegram
to
Washington.
Okay.
I mean, pages.
Yeah.
It was really probably ad nauseum for the readers. But, I wanted to be certain that we convey, not being intimately involved in the negotiations per se, nor being intimately involved in all of the discussions within the U.S. government, and not being part of all of the tortured history of U.S. attitudes toward El Salvador, I felt that I could not be absolutely certain of which kind of nuance might resonate, might have an importance that escaped me.
Mm-hmm.
That might be important to other people, so our reporting on this is quite comprehensive.
Okay. Now, as I said to you that yesterday...
Poor Joe probably never forgive me because he had to do most of the writing.
The writing. Well, details are important.
Yeah.
As I told you yesterday, I did interview Bernard Aronson.
Yeah.
And he explained some, very interesting points. He was very modest, though, about his own role,
he's a modest guy, but he was...
I wanted to ask you about, his role and the importance that he played.
He was central, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh.
Now, he may say Jim Baker was central or somebody else, but my guess is that Bernie himself was the key policymaker for the U.S. during this process. Because it's not something where you just sort of sit down one day and decide something, and then that's it. It's an evolving process that requires decisions every single day,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes many decisions as to where we are, what do we say to Cristiani, what do we recommend that he do, how do we respond to the UN, and what do we tell Watson to tell De Soto, that kind of stuff all the time.
So he was really active.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then you had Walker, Bill Walker, that I mentioned before, who you should really have to talk to as our ambassador. They're involved in meeting with Cristiani on often as necessary, foreign minister and others. You know, we too, in New York, whenever the Salvadoran foreign minister would come up, we would sit down and go over things with him at great length. He was the negotiator. He wasn't the foreign minister at that time. Now, remember, we were not talking to the FMLN.
Well, I wanted to ask you that about that, because you
so didn't, we didn't had, you mention... We had a hard... I mean, it was tough for us. I mean, any objective observer would say, how the heck can you do this? You're only talking to one side.
Right.
Well, that's one of the reasons I was talking to DeSoto, was to get as much information on the other side, what their views were, as far as possible.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that a lot of times people in Washington were very upset with what DeSoto was doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, he... he may have had his own attitudes and ideas, and not all of which would have been compatible with the Bush administration's attitudes and ideas. But on the other hand, he was in some ways looking for any solution without determining in advance what it would be that could be supported by both sides and would be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically what he was trying to do, even though he may have had some of his own biases, which may have led him from time to time in certain directions, but probably, I mean, it's obvious from my point of view, it is absolutely, it's evident that he was going to be in a position that was not exactly what the U.S. wanted, because we were one extreme, and the FMLN was the other extreme,
mm-hmm.
and whatever solution was going to be in the middle, and not necessarily satisfactory to either.
Mm-hmm.
So we also tried to make sure Washington understood this point, that DeSoto wasn't necessarily an evil person that was doing something that we didn't like and therefore was bad. I mean, because some people certainly thought that.
Mm-hmm.
He was a negotiator looking for some sort of solution that would be viable.
Right, because there was some open criticism of DeSoto.
Of course, but that's the tempers of involvement of the U.S. I mean, you talk to the people that were involved in El Salvador during that time, they still can't let go. Many of them still can't look at El Salvador today except through the lens of the past.
Yeah.
And they still look at the personalities from that time. It was a scorching, searing time for people. I had the luxury of not being involved in all that. So I felt I was in so many ways more objective than some of the others.
You could be more objective.
I could be, but I proved to be, and that's another question. I was not seared by personal experiences, which made me have very strong views about the good or evil of different people.
Yeah.
So I could be a little more detached, if you will.
Now, I believe that you mentioned actually before we started the tape about Ambassador Walker. Maybe you could clear that up again.
Well, he was obviously a key player. He's a very smart and aggressive, active guy, and I just mentioned to you earlier that you really should find a way to talk to Bill, because he did some really, first of all, being a faithful messenger of our position and getting news to Christiani, and Christiani's news back to all the rest of us, so it was a crucial thing to do. But in addition to that, he did this, made this dramatic trip, I can't quite remember the name of the town now, up to the rebel base, FMLN base, where he sat around with all the leaders there and talked to them like human beings. And that was and Bernie, at least in conversation with me, has emphasized how important that was in terms of convincing the FMLN that we were actually really interested in a negotiated solution.
Yeah, okay.
That we weren't just trying to suck them into something where they get hurt.
Yeah.
And that we were prepared to live with them in some way. Because up at that point, we weren't talking to them at all.
Yeah.
And I remember when Pete Romero, in New York, made the first contact, at one point when there was an FMLN delegation up there, the first contact between us, say U.S. government and the FMLN in these negotiations, it was all hush-hush, not public or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Bernie that did it, it wasn't even I who did it, it certainly wasn't Pickering that did it, it was Pete,
who
was Deputy Assistant Secretary or Office Director maybe at the time, whatever his title was. He was a key player, but he didn't have the sort of political salience of
or
the others.
Visibility.
And so the Walker, Bill played a crucial role. about this. And Pete Romero was Bernie's right-hand man, so he's another important person to talk to about this.
Okay. Again, in El Salvador, in November of 1989, now this was after you had joined the U.S. mission, the FMLN launched its largest attack of the war.
Right.
Had the U.S. anticipated that attack?
I don't think so. I don't remember very well. There might have been some intelligence about it, but I think my recollection is, by and large, it was a surprise.
Yeah, okay.
But that was also an absolutely crucial turning point.
Yeah,
in both ways.
Yeah.
It demonstrated to the elite of El Salvador, categorically and definitively and unforgettably, that this war was not simply among peasants scrambling around out in the countryside among themselves and hired military people and stuff like that. It actually affected them in the most personal way, like their own houses being shot at.
Yeah.
And I think it made the elite realize that they had to do something to bring this to an end, and it wasn't going to come to an end by military means.
Okay.
I think it also demonstrated the FMLN, who did the sort of like a Tet Offensive, threw everything they could into this and failed. Didn't achieve anything.
They didn't do it. Yeah, didn't
so both sides, I think that was crucial. And I think most analysts would, and people who analyze this a hell of a lot better than I have, would agree that that was a crucial point in that, and the attitudes that I described in brief fashion that came out of it were crucial to setting a psychological, if you will, a political situation conducive to a negotiated solution.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about an incident during that time in which the FMLN took the Sheraton Hotel. I don't know if you...
Well, I remember. It wasn't Baena Suarez in the hotel?
Baena Suarez was in the hotel, and they also discovered some 13 or so U.S. military personnel. Mm. I believe they were trainers or something like that. Were you involved in the negotiations to get them relieved?
No, I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't think so. I remember the incident.
But
the FMLN, they did a lot of things. They weren't idiots, and they weren't about to do something bad to the U.S. military and get us directly, even more directly involved.
I know.
They might have been tempted to.
No, they weren't tempted to, because I actually interviewed some of the leaders of the FMLN, and they told me about their surprise when they found them in the hotel. Mortified, actually, that they found them in the hotel.
But there's another whole dimension to this, and maybe you're going to get to it, and that is the creation by Pérez de Cuellar of the Friends of the Secretary General.
Yes, okay, right. I wanted to ask you about that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My own view on that has always been that this was an idea broached initially by Alvaro de Soto to Javier Pérez de Cuellar. I don't know what he says about it in his book, but it was a device designed to offset our influence. They were trying to create some other external actors that would come in, but only when the Secretary General wanted and in the way that he wanted. It wouldn't actually be like we were perceived to be sort of, you know, absolutely wedded to the Christiani administration's objectives. In other words, they wouldn't be wedded to the FMLN's objectives, but they'd be wedded to the Secretary General's objectives, and Alvaro's objectives, and would give them more resonance and help counteract us to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it didn't work out that way. And it's one of the most interesting stories. And if you talk to someone like Ambassador Jorge Montaño of Mexico, who is perhaps the leader of this group, who's now retired and living in Mexico.
I really would like to interview him.
He's up here often.
Is he?
Yeah,
I should write to him then, because I've interviewed Ambassador Tello, who is now the Mexican ambassador to the UN. But his direct involvement in El Salvador is limited because he was in Mexico during that time, but he certainly was aware of all the negotiations.
Tello was not involved because Tello was somewhere else.
Yeah. But Montaño was
important. Absolutely involved and a very important player, and I would say perhaps in a way the leader, it's a little too strong a term, but he was perhaps the most active and perhaps most influential of the four Friends.
Mm-hmm. So what was the role that they ended up playing, where you said
we became, and I think we handled this pretty well, we became the four Friends plus one.
Yeah, okay.
the Secretary General had in his hands now was five guys getting involved in this and coordinating our positions in advance and actually participating in the negotiations behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You know, so they, so poor Alvaro, I think, got something that... Hello?
Okay, so,
we ended up with a group, we met all the time.
Okay.
With the four friends and us, four friends plus one as we came to be called, and we worked out our positions together.
Yeah.
And we went back. You know, we couldn't talk to the FMLN, but the Mexicans certainly could, and the Spaniards could really talk to them very well. They've been very close to them.
Okay.
And the Colombians and the Venezuelans both were less involved directly with the combatants, but gave a certain kind of leavening element to the whole thing.
So in the group of friends during the negotiation process before the final agreement, the U.S. role was really that you met with the group of friends.
All
you
time.
Were
met every
you
week,
met,
several times a week.
You
at
could
the
meet
Mexican
with,
mission usually.
Yeah,
usually at Jorge's place.
Yeah,
yeah,
and you
nice
could meet with
Christiani. They serve good cookies.
Oh, excellent. But the one difference between you and the other four members of the group of friends was that you were not meeting directly with the FMLN.
That's right.
And because Mexico and so the other friends were meeting directly
with... They could
with
do
the,
that whenever yeah. they want. They were in touch with them.
Okay.
Including mm-hmm. with the FML representative in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Today, whatever his name was, I can't remember right now. Father who was there.
Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh.
And this was interesting. Very interesting. But I think that this is only possible because the U.S. position was also evolving very rapidly as the negotiations, despite their fitful progress, you know, looked like the only game in town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That if we're going to get any solution to this, remember how contentious this had been in the Congress and everything, all this Central American stuff. I mean, Bernie and Jim Baker did a great job diffusing that when they came in, even before Bernie was sworn in as Assistant Secretary, and cutting a deal and on Nicaragua, you know, that we would stop sending weapons to them, but, you know, if the elements that were so strongly opposed to the Contras would sort of give us a break. Forget all the specifics of it, but Bernie worked out. But I think the whole Bush administration policy was evolving toward the real, after that, the offensive and everything. If this was the only game in town, we had to try to make it work.
Right.
Okay. I may not like everything DeSoto was doing, you might have said, but we got to try to make it better. In fact, by working with these four friends, we now had five of us pressing DeSoto.
Yeah.
On certain issues.
Well,
together.
Well, I just wanted to clarify my understanding on the group of friends.
I want to make sure, let's see, I got something, I'm trying to think about this. We did meet with the FMLN negotiators in New York. I'm trying to put the meeting that Pete Romero had in context of that, and I'm just not remembering it very well.
Okay.
But I think that his meeting may have been before any of the other meetings. And then we had, you know, I met with Shafi Kandel, but usually in the company of the four friends.
Okay.
And Villalobos and all those guys. And they all came up together.
Uh-huh. But now, after the signing of the agreement in Chapultepec in January of 1992, then it seems as though the U.S. was much more in direct contact with both sides and the whole implementation.
Oh, yeah. Then it was a whole different... That was different.
Okay.
The negotiations were completed that midnight whatever it was, 91?
Yeah, December 31st, 1991.
Stopped the clock and wouldn't let Pérez de Cuellar leave, you know,
right.
All that, right?
Yeah.
His wife had to fly off with the Nambolas to the Bahamas in their private plane and Javier to stay behind. There's a lot of stories there.
Well, actually, Bernard Aronson was saying that Javier Pérez de Cuellar was actually going to leave in the afternoon on that day.
He was.
Yeah. So what happened that he could finally stay till midnight?
He said beyond midnight. He was no longer Secretary General. We stopped the clock, like in a labor negotiation, literally.
Yeah.
It was not till 1 that it was done. I mean, it was amazing.
Okay.
He because everyone looked at him and said, you cannot walk out in this fucking process. Right. You are the central figure to this goddamn thing. You just can't abandon this. We are far from an agreement.
So at that
point, you're not going to leave this room.
I mean, so at that point, the friends went to speak to him?
Some people were saying, like, I think Alvaro de Soto was saying, I was not necessarily, a Tom Pickering and Jorge Montano, I think, went up and talked to him. I don't remember all of the details. I was not in that room at that time.
Okay.
What I hear is, and I've not heard this from Alvaro, so I better be careful, de Soto was saying he should leave. They weren't going to get me.
That's my understanding.
But these guys were saying, absolutely, no, you have to stay here. We'll stop the crisis. I'm no longer Secretary General. Who cares? Just this process going.
Yeah. Now, why
meanwhile, you had everybody downstairs. You had the FMLN in one place, and you had the government people in another, and the current President Calderon Sol was there. He was handling one part of it. You had generals handling other parts of it. Cristiani, like a masterful conductor, with a cigarette in his hand, just sort of calm way, you know, making all decisions without any problem. His wife there, terrific.
Yeah.
The whole show. I just found a picture. Why, I don't know why, lying around in my bedroom of a bunch of us, Cristiani and Pickering and I and somebody else standing there that night.
Really?
Just lying around some pictures.
If you would be interested in donating that to the oral history collection, that would be great. Or a copy, if you have the negatives or something.
I'll have to see. I don't even know who took it, where it came from.
Yeah, that would be great.
And that was a rough night, but Goulding played a crucial role in this.
What was Goulding's role then?
Well, he was the peacemaker guy, head of peacekeeping in the UN. His job was sort of basic. Theoretically, simply dealing with the deployment of troops and those kinds of things on this.
That's right. Okay.
But and when de Soto was the political negotiator, but that's but Goulding expanded his role too.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of real actual negotiating. He was really tough in some of those negotiations. I understand, not having been in the room, of course. Something about a sword. There's a great story here somewhere, but maybe Bernie remembers it better than I.
Mm-hmm, okay.
That he took some kind of a ceremonial sword lying around his office and slammed it down the table.
Oh my goodness. Oh, that's great. Oh dear.
There were some comic opera elements of it. Everybody was tense, and everybody was trying to get the last drop out of the negotiating stone, and of course there was still a lack of confidence all over the place. But it finally ended, and where did I just see a picture? Maybe it was in what you just showed. Did you just show me something?
Oh, the book.
Oh, in the book, the picture,
Yeah, okay.
People were standing around making these press announcements at the end, and then we all went home.
Mm-hmm.
I had my whole family around for a New Year's Eve party at our house. Our apartment was on Fifth Avenue, right along with East Central Park, and I walked in there, and they're all sound asleep on the couch.
With silly hats on. I was doing a morning, 2:30 in the morning.
Right. Oh, dear.
Yeah, my brother down from Connecticut, his kid there,
and
I was, of course, elated. Full of adrenaline, wide awake.
Yeah, because you just achieved something very important.
And
I've
been drinking champagne or something all evening and passed out there. Little kids were killed.
I wanted to just back up a little bit, because that was the end of 1991. But after the FMLN offensive in 1989, and in relation to that, the Salvadoran military had responded by killing a group of Jesuit priests.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the impact of the offensive and how that sort of changed the view of the situation. How did the killing of the Jesuit priests impact the perception?
I think that was enormously important also, and probably many different ways. I can't be too precise on this. But this is something, Bill Walker deserves a considerable amount of credit in sort of digging out what happened there.
Oh, okay.
Ambassador.
Okay.
And can't remember all the details now, but they just kept going at it and going at it and going at it, and even though people were telling them to stop, find out who did it and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
My recollection is that it had a couple of different kinds of impacts. One was that it just revealed to everybody the horror of the situation. We need to end this. This is just becoming even more horrible every day.
Okay.
Right there in downtown. Once again, a little bit like that impact of the raid. This affects us all. You may not like these priests and all that sort of stuff, but my heavens, this is not acceptable. On the other hand, though, I think it probably made it more difficult for some elements of the military to participate wholeheartedly, that's the right word, in, if they ever did, in the negotiations, because they were scared.
Okay.
They'd be strung up.
Okay.
Somehow. So I think it had, but it was certainly a dramatic event. And I think it put pressure on everybody to try to end this thing.
Okay. Okay. And then
of course it was a key, they had to, the negotiations resulted in a whole lot of military people having to be moved out, retiring, leaving. That event had something to do with who had to leave.
Oh, okay. Okay. Had the U.S. been in conversation with the Soviet Union or with Cuba on Central America, either on Nicaragua or El Salvador?
My recollection is no. But there were people, at one point, Pérez de Cuellar was talking about having the Cubans involved, but not even FMLN wanted the Cubans involved. And they were, Cuba was an irrelevancy by that point.
By that point, yeah.
Yeah, in the 70s and maybe even early 80s it wasn't, but by that point, it didn't have anything it could bring to the table.
Yeah, okay.
So, it never got involved. The Four Friends didn't involve the Cubans. Cubans were not involved in any of this in any significant way. There were there was a moment there where there was some talk about it, and I just can't, I can almost remember it, but not entirely, about something that the Cubans were going to do in terms of a visit or something, but it never materialized.
Well, now you talked about the importance of Jorge Montaña and the group of friends.
Montaño, and O is the last.
Montaño, oh.
Yeah.
What about the president of Venezuela?
Carlos Andrés Pérez?
Yes, because I had heard many stories that he was extremely active.
I think he was active. I can't remember now anything, the specific things, but he put up money in Nicaragua to provide security for Violeta, things like that.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Yeah, one reason he ended up in jail is that he had this big slush fund that he used for foreign policy.
Right.
And he had plenty of money to throw around, so he could import. He flew people around on planes. Yeah. He hired security people, did all kinds of, God knows what else he did with that money that he had.
Yeah.
And he was very active. He was active. I think all of the presidents were active. I think that Salinas was active too.
Yeah.
Not as, Carlos Andrés Pérez liked this stuff more than any, he was involved in it.
So personally, he liked to be active in the
stuff. And he had an active, Diego Arria, who was the, he's still in New York, you might want to talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
His English is absolutely perfect. And,
yeah.
He's still living there in New York, so you might want to see him. Talk to him about this. He'll give you a lot of stories, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Rather flamboyant. Personality. And then Fernando Cepeda. It was the Colombian during most of this time, and he is now there as of a few weeks ago. Their new ambassador to the OAS.
Oh.
So you could talk to him too.
Cepeda and
then Yanez, who's in this picture here, first Paco de Villar, who is in fact the Spanish observer at the OAS right now, interestingly enough.
Oh, really?
Was the first member, the Spanish perm rep that was involved in all this.
Okay.
I had lots of meetings with him on the side at the very beginning of this process.
What is his name again? The Spanish perm rep?
Francisco de Villar, D E V-I-L-L-A-R. And he's the perm rep to the OAS, and he was the perm rep to the UN. And then he went back to be number two in their foreign ministry, and then when Gonzalez lost the election, he's moved out here. Less important position. He's so identified with the socialist administration. Then after him, there was Yanez. Right here.
Okay.
Right here, next to Montaño. That's Montaño.
Oh, okay.
And that's Yanez.
Okay. That actually is a really good picture, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know where Tom or any of us. See, it doesn't have, doesn't really describe who's in the back right here. Oh, this is Cepeda, here. Here's Cepeda, and here's Aria. So those are the four friends.
Oh, okay.
Four friends, these four guys. Yeah, I hadn't looked at this closely.
Oh, excellent.
And then, and here's Calderon Salt, the current president.
Yeah, I recognized him, okay, we're referring to a photograph that's in the memoirs of Perez de Cuellar.
Yeah, the last one in the section of photographs here,
just before
2:15, before chapter 9.
What kinds of...
You're all good guys. All those guys were great. It must have been difficult. It was interesting for them. They had very different personalities and different approaches to this, but they work together extremely nicely and always in a very forthright and open way, very easy to deal with.
I mean, now that you're saying this, was this just a lucky gathering of people, or could this be orchestrated again to have a group of friends that work with Secretary General on some other kind of
peace? Group of friends idea is now used over and over again now. I'm trying to think.
On Haiti.
They went on
Guatemala.
Haiti, and that's just in a way, it comes out of the Contadora process.
Yeah.
These were the leaders of Contadora.
Right.
That whole process had expanded out into the whole real group now, for a whole much wider agenda. And all of this is interesting in a Latin American historical context because, the Latins didn't usually work together on anything.
Mm.
My recollection is the first time in history where all the Latin American presidents met without the presence of the United States was in about 1987 in Mexico.
Oh.
Yeah, 200 years after, or 180 years after this, they were founded as countries. Really, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And now they meet and talk to all the time. They have the Rio group, they have Mercosur, they have a variety of things. They're on the phone, they see each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's amazing.
Very, very interesting. A very important development, too. I think maybe the Contadora thing, that sort of galvanized this process.
Yeah. What kind of incentives or leverage did the U.S. Use during the process?
Well, we had the promise of assistance, which was large. And I think, as I said earlier, everybody recognized that there wasn't going to be a solution without us as part of it. Now, how do you make us part of it? Freddie Christiani might have been able to make us part of some things that we wouldn't want to be part of. If he said, I've got to have this, and we would say, after all, we're supporting him, there's probably a range of latitude there where something could be quite a range there. But if Christiani didn't like it, sometimes I think we had to work to persuade him or to buck him up. He was negotiating, in a political context in El Salvador, in his own administration, in the military, all kinds of other people all over.
Yeah.
So that's another story that's worth someone looking into, the whole how the Salvadorans handled this. I think those are basically it. We had assistance, we had influence on Christiani, and influence elsewhere in the world. We can marshal other resources. I think those were.
Yeah. Okay. The first actual agreement that was reached between the parties was on human rights in July of 1990. So that would have been about a year after you had joined the mission. What was the U.S. view on this agreement and coming to an agreement on human rights without a ceasefire?
Well, I think that we were pushing for a ceasefire, the end of the conflict above all else. I wouldn't be honest if I could try to tell you exactly how we reacted. I mean, I know that my view all along was that this was, that I accepted the idea that the process had to be piecemeal.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not sure everybody in Washington did.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, people want a comprehensive agreement, but sometimes you can't get there because you don't have enough confidence or enough experience with the other guy to get there. So you need to do things that lead you there. Okay. Sort of like the Middle East.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyone who sits down and says, this is what the solution to the Middle East should be, will lose immediately. Everybody will reject it.
Yeah.
You have to get there. And you only get there if people have confidence enough in each other and feel serious enough about changing the situation for the better that they then start, you know, incrementally moving there and defining real options and making real choices.
Okay.
And if you told them that at the beginning that what they'd end up with is what they were going to end up with, they'd probably all say you were crazy.
Right.
But so it's so there's a process that has to go on inside people's brains, and you need to bring them along.
Right.
And after all, I mean, the human rights thing was a major step. Now, many people would say, you know, the human rights thing was designed to get at the military and all that stuff. Well, okay, so what?
Mm-hmm.
But that builds confidence on the part of the FMLN.
Okay,
you
know? Yeah.
And besides, some of the things the military did, you know, were really bad.
Yeah.
But also, if I remember correctly, they set up this panel that went to examine the human rights situation. That took place, it didn't finish its work until I was in Washington as assistant secretary.
Uh-huh.
And they came back and they looked at the evidence and they accused all sorts of people of different kinds of things. But as it happens in Latin America, a lot of people are upset about this, but it happens all the time. And once you get to that point, a lot of people say, well, let's go get the bastards.
Mm-hmm.
And the Latinos invariably say no.
Mm-hmm.
They say, we could spend all our time in retribution for the past, opening up more and more wounds. Or we can say, in a way that Americans would have a hard time doing, that happened and it's horrible, and now let's forget it and let's look at the future.
Right.
You know, and it's a tough call. And human rights groups in the U.S. and elsewhere, understandably, you know, are very frustrated by this. But it happened in Chile, it happened in Uruguay, it happened in Brazil, it happened in El Salvador,
yeah.
It happened in Nicaragua. It happened with a little hesitation. I mean, in Argentina, they actually threw the generals in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're all out. But they were. I mean, the Argentinians were the exception to this rule, or at least a period.
So what's the result, or what is the purpose of this combination of a truth commission report, which names names, and then the amnesty?
What I said, I think. That's the way they deal with this.
Uh-huh.
The evidence is out there. And this happened in Chile, I think, you know, quite dramatically. And I think it's generally, now there are enough examples of this, that people, although uncomfortable, are willing to do this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If people want information, I want to know what happened to my son or daughter.
Okay.
Where were they killed?
Okay.
Where are they buried? And
okay.
What happened?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know who did it.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't have it. It's not essential that I know that. Because I know basically, I don't have to pin on a single individual. I know what bastards did it to me. But nothing's going to bring this son of mine back again.
Yeah.
And what we have to avoid is the horror of this affecting any more people's sons and daughters. That's that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So in Chile, you have all this information out there, but there's, you know, virtually no retribution. I mean, really, the only case in Chile is Contreras and Company, the secret Dina chief, and that was largely because the U.S. insisted on it because they murdered Ambassador Letelier up here at the circle. And the young woman, his aide, Moffat, was with him. And that was a murder in the United States, and the United States administration at the time was the Reagan administration, if I remember correctly, decided that that we would try to insist on something other than impunity in this case.
And we
forced that on the Chileans. Those are the only guys that are really in jail.
Yeah. We talked about Ambassador Thomas Pickering at the UN. How would you evaluate his role in the process? I mean, he had been the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador previously.
Well, he was, first of all, enormously respected by everybody and liked, and knew a lot about El Salvador, and always had tremendous energy and creativity. Whenever we were doing anything up there, you know, the rest of us would be sort of sharpening our pencils to get ready to write something. You already have it done. We're his aide. We're supposed to be helping him. He does it. Did it already. Yeah. How about this for a resolution? We're going, where's the... Put in the first word on the page and he's done the whole thing. And I think everybody viewed him as a person of goodwill. And they also viewed him as a person with tremendous standing within the administration. So you were dealing with a very valid interlocutor.
Okay.
And a couple of occasions, I think, where I was not present, he and Montaño and some of those other guys, you know, really, there were moments when we got directly involved in sort of negotiations, right on the edge, we're talking to the Christiani government and others, you know, talking to the Secretary General. Tom played a crucial role in pushing people toward the right direction.
Did it make a difference that he spoke
fluent? But he left most of the stuff that I've been describing to you up to me.
Okay.
But if I ever needed him, you know, he was there. I could ask him and he'd come in if I needed support or further authority or a better idea than I could come up with, you know. He was directly involved, although he dealt it, and he was fully, you know, I kept him fully briefed on everything and all that stuff. He was directly involved, but he largely delegated this one to me, but monitoring it all the way and able to step in and tell me what he wanted if I wasn't doing something I didn't want.
Yeah. So this may be a sort of a really detailed question, but it just occurred to me that Ambassador Pickering spoke Spanish because he had been in El Salvador.
Right.
You spoke Spanish because
right.
you'd been in Peru.
Right.
What language was the final agreement written in? Was that in English or was it written in Spanish?
I think, you see, what happened was those negotiations at midnight on December 31st of 91 resulted in agreements on all the key issues, which had been identified by the process that Alvaro de Soto set up, you know. And you really have to give Alvaro a lot of credit. You know, he may have reservations, but you really, you know, he put together a successful negotiation, identified the issues, and got them on the table, and set about a process which, under President Cuellar's leadership and the participation of a whole bunch of other people as well, you know, produced results. But then came the process of writing it all down.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a negotiation where you ended up at 2 in the morning on the 1st of January, 92, with an absolutely clean text.
Right.
Then they had to sit down and write what this was, and then reconsult, and they were, oh my God, that's not what we meant, that's not what we agreed to, bullshit, that's what you agreed to. Kind of stuff. It required a lot of firmness.
Yeah.
On part of the UN people who are writing this, not to let it slip away again, because these guys, you know, especially if I'm ill. I mean, they would take advantage of anything they could to try to twist it a little bit more
in their
direction. Who can blame them? But that's so it took a lot. That's another very interesting part of this.
Yeah.
But my recollection is that most of the negotiating was being done in Spanish.
Okay.
Because it was between the FMLN and El Salvador's, the Cristiano administration.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of the meetings that I went to with the four friends, and when I was also meeting eventually with the Lobos and Shocking Candle and the FMLN guys, well, those were all in Spanish. But you need to also know that Pickering picked his deputies with these things in mind.
He did.
Oh yeah, he wanted a person for Asia, a person for Latin America, a person for Africa. He could handle the Middle East, an ambassador to Israel and Jordan.
Okay.
You know, but we had a couple of Middle East experts on the staff. The mission staff was designed to be able to cover the waterfront.
Okay.
I was a Latin America guy, obviously, as well as being the principal deputy.
Okay.
Jim Wilkinson was Asia.
Jonathan
Moore was Africa.
Yeah.
And Shereen Kaylee was Indian subcontinent. Pakistani, but anyhow.
Well, the question is.